This talk was given by Susan Taikyo-Gilman at the Zen Center of New York City. Taikyo is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order and is currently serving as the assistant training coordinator. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thank you for listening.
The title of this talk is Imagine It Real. And this is from Shantideva's Way of the Bodhisattva, Chapter 10, which Shugen Roshi pulled out and has been offering us this ongo, this 90-day training period. By virtue of my merits, may all beings everywhere tormented by sufferings of body and mind find physical comfort and mental joy. May the regions of hell become joyful lands adorned with vast and fragrant lotus pools, resounding with the enchanting calls of wild geese, ducks, and swans. May the hail of lava, blazing stones, and weapons henceforth become a rain of flowers. And may all attacks with weapons from now on become a playful exchange of flowers. May the frightened be released from their fears. May those in captivity be freed. May the powerless be endowed with power. And may people think only of benefiting one another. By the power of the merit I have accumulated, may all living beings without exception abandon all forms of evil and always engage in virtue. May the bodhisattvas fulfill the welfare of the world in every manner they have intended, and may all living beings receive everything the Buddhas have intended for them. As long as space exists, and for as long as living beings remain in samsara, in this suffering world, may I abide among them to dispel all their suffering. So I wanted to take up imagination as a way of setting our intentions in practice. And I'm also going to talk about courage, the courage we can take in our actions and the effort, the joyful effort and determination and steadfastness we can bring to bringing some benefit into the world. So there was a question in one of the question and answer sessions, the mandos that we did with Shugen Roshi up at the monastery, about the sila paramita, the perfection of morality. And the question was, what is the source of goodness in Buddha nature? And it's kind of a question that I've had too, like, if all things come into being and disappear, there's everything is empty, nothing truly exists. What about goodness? You know, what about that aspiration to really be of benefit to others? What is that in Buddha nature as we understand it? And his answer kind of looked at how we humans are meaning-making people. Things come up and we make meaning out of them. We make them real. We make them fixed. We explain them to ourselves and to others. This is kind of our gift and also our kind of tragedy in a way. So we make significance of things that arise, all our mental phenomenon, you know, our envy and our greed, you know, we sort of fix them in place. And that is the material of practice. That's what we work with. So even if you don't know much about Buddhist philosophy or the Dharma, we instinctively want to do good. You know, you see somebody fall, you want to help them up. Somebody's crying, you're like, what's going on? You know, there's a way that we respond very naturally. And the heart opens, compassion flows, and then we get hurt because there's so much. This is the Bodhisattva's dilemma. Everywhere you look, it's compounded, there's suffering. Suffering that arises kind of naturally, disasters and suffering that we cause each other, suffering we cause ourselves. So we can numb out, and that's the place where most of us come to practice, hurting, feeling the sorrow, and a little numb. So when we sit down, that numbness, in a way, is that's a layer to work with. And it is, it's a little frightening to get below the numbness. So the Bodhisattva, the being on the path of enlightenment, has an aspiration to liberate all beings. And this is the theme of our Ongo, that bodhicitta, which is the Buddha mind or thought that arises. Bodhicitta isn't just the desire to do good, it's the desire to do good based on what the Dharma teaches, to bring forth enlightenment that is not based on anything that is going to disintegrate. So everything that comes into being is actually empty. There's nothing really fixed in it if we investigate this very deeply. And yet it arises. And so bodhicitta is that arising of that aspiration to realize the Dharma, to realize the truth in the Heart Sutra, that form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. It is that aspiration to realize it for the benefit of others, for the benefit of all beings. Because something has arisen, suffering, it has a cause. There are causes and conditions that bring everything into being, happiness and our suffering. So I'm going to be looking a bit more about how that comes together. I think we all experience, you know, how we kind of create our own kind of little tangles of emotions. But we also have found the path and have found the way to sit and settle. And intuitively, even if this is your first day here, you know, there's something that you connect with. And that something is quite large. And it's kind of elusive, too. It's like it's, okay, so there's this method. You sit down, you feel your breath, and that everything that happens from there is, it's kind of like you're imagining it real. You're making it a practice. So there's a teaching in the Tibetan tradition. We're a Zen tradition that came through China to Japan, but in the Tibetan tradition, it's very, very much a kind of sister practice of ours within what's called the Mahayana. And there was a teacher called Longchenpa and others who noted that we can understand two aspects of bodhicitta, the intention and the action. And the intention is said to be like planning to go on a journey. You know, you get your maps, you set your itinerary, you get excited about it. So that's the intention. It's all kind of happening. And then the action is actually going on the journey, you know. You get your suitcase, you're out the door, and you don't really know what's going to happen. You know, delays, disappointments, surprises, meeting people. That's the journey. That's the action, in a sense. And we go back and forth between those two, you know, setting the intention, say, in Zazen, and actually doing it. Actually doing it. So we, as you probably noticed today, we dedicate a lot of our practice. After we do a chant, there's a dedication. And when you sit down to sit, there's sitting, you know, establishing your seat and bringing your practice to mind. So that's intention setting as well. Even if it's just like setting time to sit, you know, I'm going to sit, okay, 20 minutes. Okay. I'm just going to sit. And then there's focusing on the practice itself. Okay, I'm going to really feel my breath. And then if you're practicing with a text or a koan, as you settle, you bring that to mind and you bring it into your body. So it's really opening to what is arising, even if it gets challenging, the distractions. And in this way, Zazen really isn't a space for imagining things or, you know, fantasizing. The instructions are don't follow a thought, don't add extra, you know, just come back, come back. But it is a space for seeing clearly. And that's kind of the mystery. It's like how to do that without getting caught up in it. How to really just experience a pattern, you know? Sort of circling, circling, circling. It's that thing you've done before. It feels a certain way. And the invitation is to really experience what's happening without adding extra. And to let that be really embodied so that it completely fills you. And in that way, not analyzing where it came from or how it came into being, but just sort of experiencing that it has come into being. And therefore, it is not fixed. It's not forever. We can recreate those patterns, and basically we do that. So being able to see that pattern is part of letting it go. And Zazen is finding your body, really like finding your true body that is free of distractions, free of the kleshas, the kind of constricting emotions that come up, the very strong ones, that may just really be so deeply seated in our bodies, you know, rooted that they come up whenever we sit. I mean, I probably cried through my first 5 years of practice, particularly during session, the meditation intensives. And part of that was because so much of it was built up in my body. And it just had to kind of come through. And to trust that, you know, to trust what arises as being exactly what should be coming up at that moment for you. It's not more than you can handle, even if your heart is breaking. To really just let it break open. Let it break open completely so that that presence can be true. And that's the freedom in our Buddha nature, is to just be present with what is arising. Buddha nature is said to be always present. It hasn't come into being. You don't create it. It doesn't extinguish when you move away from it or when your body just falls away and you pass from this life. Buddha nature is, it just is. It's the enlightened state. It's the enlightened mind. It's very big. And so touching in with that is, it's kind of what we touch when we touch in with Zazen. It's that alive, very alive. Open, unconditioned body that we share. Daito Roshi was fond of saying, I don't know if I can get his voice right, you are not it, but it is no other than you. So practicing with bodhicitta also means staying with what's difficult, and it takes effort. It takes some imagination sometimes. Actually, I had lots of like digressions and asides when I was putting together this talk, and one of them was just recognizing how delicious it is to like work on an art project in my mind during Zazen. Or a recipe, or you know, something. It's like it's totally abstract, and yet I can feel it, I can see it. It's delicious. So for me, a practice is to just acknowledge that's happening, note it, let it go. It's not what this time is for. But it's a very open space, and a lot can come up that's very free and very fluid, and that's the beauty of it. So, here's another digression, but it'll come back. About 10 years ago, Claudia Rankine, who's a poet and a writer, co-authored a book called The Racial Imaginary. And it was a looking at the constructs of racism through creative activity, through poetry, through art, through discussions, through analysis. And it's continued in a slightly different form, but it's called the Racial Imaginary Institute. And they have a website that is kind of continuously seeded with new work. And on the website, they say the Racial Imaginary Institute seeks to change the way we imagine race in the U.S. and internationally by lifting up and connecting the work of artists, writers, knowledge producers, and activists with audiences seeking thoughtful, innovative conversations and experiences. The work of defining and changing culture is all of ours. It belongs to us. So it's creating space for our minds to kind of unpack what these constructs, what these systems are, to dismantle them so that something else can be imagined. You can't do it unless those things come apart. And in the Dharma, that's a very foundational practice. And in the original teachings of the Buddha, way back, like a couple hundred years after he passed, something called the Abhidharma was constructed, which is a way of looking at mind, like all our states of consciousness and thought, and systematizing it, like naming it all. And it is so elaborate and dense, and but it also gave a foundation for a kind of more full exploration of the Buddha's teachings on emptiness and on interdependence, the way causes and conditions have brought all of conditioned existence into being, and those things change. And so I don't recommend this for anybody unless you're super interested, but looking at the Abhidharma and the teachings of Nagarjuna and the Yogacara school, it's very interesting as you develop your practice. And there's something called these mental factors. There are unwholesome mental factors. There are beautiful mental factors, which are wholesome. There are 52 of these mental factors, and they're really interesting. And there's a writer, a Buddhist scholar, Andrew Olensky, who wrote this nice piece on the Abhidharma. And he wrote, an important principle of the system is that wholesome and unwholesome factors can never arise together in the same moment. So envy or sorrow, it can't arise at the same time as generosity, giving, like real giving. And to understand that about ourselves. And we can take our jealousy and our insufficiency and replace it with an affirmation. Like, we can really bring these states of consciousness forward for ourselves and for the benefit of all beings. And I always come back to Zazen as being that space where it was something difficult, but I really connected with it and I wanted to offer it to others. And I remember asking Daito Roshi, I'd only been practicing for a year, is it okay if I give beginning instruction at this community center in the Lower East Side for needle users and such? And he looked at me with those Yoda eyes and he said, sure, just don't say it has anything to do with Zen Mountain Monastery. Because I was so new, like, what did I know, you know? I knew, you know, sit down, breathe, count your breath. And that's, you know, the aspiration, is that you want to share it. It's good. You want to share it. Dogen Zenji wrote, this aspiration is not self, not other, does not come from somewhere else. However, after arousing this aspiration, when taking up the great earth, all of it turns into gold. When stirring the great ocean, it immediately turns into nectar. After arousing this aspiration, if you hold mud, stones, or pebbles, they also take up the aspiration for enlightenment. If you practice splashes of water, bubbles, or flames, they intimately bring forth the aspiration for enlightenment. It communicates now to everything. And this aspiration is grounding, as is Zazen, and coming out of Zazen, there is a kind of insight that we have, you know, about what is good, to bring forward. And that is I think of that as the space for imagining. You know, it's grounded, energetic, easeful. And I had wondered in this regard about the paramita, the perfection of morality, sila. As with Buddha nature, how do we know right from wrong, really? And this is a complicated topic, so I'm just going to kind of touch in on it a little bit. I was listening to an interview recently between Ezra Klein and Ta-Nehisi Coates about Ta-Nehisi Coates' new book called The Message, where he visited the West Bank and was hosted by these former members of the Israeli Defense Forces, an organization called Breaking the Silence, which has been working very hard to make the awareness of the state of things in the West Bank and in Gaza, formerly, of how bad it had gotten in the last 20 years, with how the lack of resources and opportunity, the constricted state, was very much like the segregated South in this country, very much like South Africa, and that this this hurt. It hurt to see it and feel it, and that it was wrong. And in this interview, they both agreed that, you know, however it came to being, the causes and conditions that brought this situation to be, it came into being. It's not fixed. And it's wrong. And to be able to have the courage to notice that and act from that place is compassion. And so the causes and conditions are real, and yet. On the ZMM website right now, there's a new splash page that was sort of brought forward by the teachers and seniors, because we've wanted to respond to conflict in the world based on hatred in some way, and this is a step in that direction. And this page says, hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. By compassion alone is hatred appeased. This is the eternal law. I'm going to read it again. Hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. By compassion alone is hatred appeased. This is an eternal law. That's from the Buddha's teachings, early teachings. And then it says, may we open new pathways to creating societies that value and nurture generosity and peace, and may we realize the Buddha way together. So may it be so. Also on the Racial Imaginary website is a piece written by, I guess he's a scholar, Roderick Ferguson, and he wrote this last year, in 2023. And the piece is called An Interruption of Our Cowardice. And he says, in a sermon, Martin Luther King said, I believe today that there is a need for all people of goodwill to come with a massive act of conscience and say, we ain't gonna study war no more. This is the challenge facing modern people. And those words are still very apt. And he said, King suggested that courage demands that conscience prioritize what is just and humane over what is safe and normative. And that courage is a habit necessary for us to cultivate to oppose racism, colonialism, and war. And he says further, courage suggests that incurring risk is an archetypal way of claiming humanity, our own and that of others. Indeed, whether we are talking about enslaved people, Holocaust survivors, occupied people, segregated people, trans women facing police violence, communities confronting genocide, or people who abdicate their privilege rather than retain it, how to make good use of our vulnerability rather than our privilege appears to be central. And he said, there are those who would say that this willful exposure to risk has little rewards for the one who stands in harm's way. But if we look closely enough, we can notice new discoveries and powers unfold for the ones who work up courage. And he notes that these are actually permanent changes in human cultures. This is how we've evolved as communities. And so we have to take that long view. And bodhicitta, becoming a realized being for the benefit of others, it's counterintuitive in a lot of ways, because we're just sort of losing that level of protection that we think we often need. And offering it, wishing that all beings be free from suffering, that all beings know peace and happiness, that we take joy in each other's joy, and that we know equanimity, peacefulness. This has to come from a grounded place. And putting others first, it requires some faith in the Dharma, because those habits are so strong. Faith that what has come into being can change. It's all going to change, unless we continue repeating the old patterns and habits. And therefore, goodness can arise, but it has to be put before greed and anger and ignorance. So the six perfections, the paramitas, are something else that we've taken up the Sangha, and they are giving, generosity, and morality. Also patience and diligence. Another translation for diligence is joyful effort, and I like that a little bit better, and also wisdom. And so these are all perfections when the self gets taken out of the picture, when you just sort of like, it's not about me, it's about us, it's about all. And that's when they become perfections, perfect effort. And this joyful effort is also steadfastness. And as we imagine peace and coexistence, a truly post-colonial world, a post-Holocaust world, post-genocide world, we can bring forth that joyful effort. It's kind of a renewal of that energy. And the present moment, you know, it's where we think and act. So being present becomes that place. There's all histories. We all have histories. There is a history of humanity. There are causes and conditions. But we don't live there. We live here, this moment. So we have the choice. That's one of our gifts of consciousness, so that we always have choices to make. Zen Master Sheng Yen noted three kinds of diligence. There's a diligence like armor that protects us. There's the diligence that's like gathering of the virtues, like good qualities, joyful effort. And then there's the diligence, the joyful effort that comes from compassion. So, oh, how are you? How are you really? You know, tell me. So, this bodhicitta calls for courage and perseverance, all the paramitas, I think especially joyful effort and renewal. And I was looking at, there's this blog by a woman named Maria Popova called the Marginalian. Used to have another name, but and she kind of sums up her year every year. And so she was giving 18, I think she's been doing this for 18 years. She gave those summations in her latest newsletter. And number 14 was called Choose Joy. And she writes, choose it like a child chooses the shoe to put on the right foot, the crayon to paint the sky. Choose it at first consciously, effortlessly, pressing against the weight of a world heavy with reasons for sorrow, restless with need for action. Feel the sorrow, take the action, but keep pressing the weight of joy against it all until it becomes mindless, automatic, like gravity pulling the stream down its course, until it becomes an inner law of nature. Joy is not a function of a life free of friction and frustration, but a function of focus and inner elevation by the fulcrum of choice. And freedom to choose is, it's not without friction. We're going against habits, conditions, safety. And again, from Dogen's Aspiration for Enlightenment, he writes, "It's not without cause that minds and all things, self and other, come together. Therefore, the moment you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, myriad things become conditions that increase this aspiration. At each moment, all aspirations for enlightenment and attainments of the way are born and perish. If they were not born and did not perish at each moment, the unwholesome actions of the past moments would not go away. If the unwholesome actions in the past moments did not go away, wholesome actions in their future moments would not manifest at this moment. The scale of this moment can only be known by the Tathagatas. The mind of this moment manifests one word. The word of this moment expounds one letter." So, as we go forward into this beautiful day and this fall, bring the knowledge that your intentions, when set, are unstoppable, and that your stable mind can be very large and bring forth great benefit, and trust that. And thank you for being here today.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.